Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Peyto Exploration and Development Corp. third quarter results conference call. I would now like to turn the meeting over to Mr. Darren Gee, President and CEO. Please go ahead.
Great. Well, thank you, Wayne. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, everybody who's listening in this morning to our third quarter 2016 results conference call. Thanks for joining us. It's a pretty busy week, what with all that's going on south of the border and then all the companies that are releasing this week. We'll try and keep this call relatively brief, but hopefully informative for everybody. Before we get started today, I would like to remind everybody that all statements made by the company during this call today are subject to the forward-looking disclaimer and advisory that we have set forth in our third quarter news release that we issued yesterday. In the room with me today is all of the Peyto management team. We've got Scott Robinson, our Chief Operating Officer, Kathy Turgeon, our CFO, Dave Thomas, our VP Exploration, J.P. Lachance, our VP Exploitation, Tim Louie, our VP of Land, Lee Curran, our VP of Drilling and Completions, and Todd Burdick, our VP of Production. Before I get started with my general comments about the quarter today, I do want to recognize the efforts of the entire Peyto team. We saw some tremendous volatility this past quarter, especially in natural gas prices, and that really required our whole team to stay on their toes, to remain as nimble as we can possibly be with our decision-making and with our operations. On behalf of all of Peyto shareholders, I just want to throw out a great big thank you to the entire team for that superior effort. On to our third quarter results. We were much busier in this third quarter than in the second quarter. We drilled 40 wells, which I think is the same number that we drilled in the third quarter last year, but for significantly less money. Average horizontal drilling costs were again 1.8 million this past quarter, and I think we drilled some wells as low as 1.5 million. By my tally, I think we've drilled seven or eight wells this year for less than 1.5 million. We're definitely grinding away on drilling costs and paying very close attention to execution, which is great to see. Of course, there are still always a couple of difficult wells every quarter, but that's always the way it is. We're in the Deep Basin, and it's a complicated drilling area. I would say that we're getting better and better at mitigating those risks and preventing them from becoming any kind of cost runaways. Completion costs for the quarter were way down. Average completions this year are trending around 800,000 versus 1.2 million last year. We're doing more and more with recycled water, trying to do more pad completions, and those kind of things are having a very positive effect all around, especially on the cost side. Average well results that we're seeing this year, I think, are still at the higher end of the range for all of our years of horizontal drilling so far. When you combine those better results on average with lower costs, we are making better relative returns, which is a good thing, or at least we're making the same returns as we were making before, but we can now endure lower commodity prices, which is also what we're seeing. That's good. With recovery of natural gas prices throughout the quarter back above $2 and continuing to climb, we started bringing all the wells that we'd inventoried in the first half of the year back online. It was a busy quarter lining out all these new wells and balancing their flows against the other 1,000 or so producers that we have. Then in the middle of the quarter, we had to reverse some of that effort for a couple of weeks when gas price dropped so dramatically back down to less than $0.50 at one point. Then the price popped back up again, and so we were back on bringing gas on again. Like I say, it was a tough quarter from a production operation standpoint, but as I mentioned, our team stayed on their toes, and we reacted very quickly to all that volatility. Great job by the team there. We did all of this in what I would say would be less than optimal ground conditions. It's been a very wet summer, not necessarily, I guess, in total amounts of rainfall, but the rain we did have came in big downpours out in the field, which I think at times made it difficult for us to move the big equipment around. We even had to deal with some sporadic road bans in the third quarter, which that's quite rare that we actually get road bans in the third quarter. We're used to it in breakup, but not typically throughout the summer and into the fall. I think from that perspective, it was quite a challenging quarter operationally wise. Cost-wise, another great job by the team of grinding away on costs and controlling costs on all fronts. Our cash costs totaled 76 cents in MCFE, which I think is industry-leading. And had we been able to really to reach our full productive capacity in the quarter, I think we'd be closer to 72, 73 cents. So we're definitely getting really close to that goal that we set at the start of the year of about 70 cents in MCFE. I know it was a lofty goal, but it's good to set those targets out there and then strive for them. If we can get anywhere close to that 70 cent mark, we're doing a fantastic job on costs. Funds from operations were $128 million, capital expenditures $114 million, and dividends of $53. So we did have more dollars going out the door than coming in, but that's by design. We are trying to be countercyclical to the industry here, take advantage of these low activity levels and low costs, and see if we can get as much capital deployed in this environment as we can. We know we're going to make better returns in this environment than on the other side of the cycle. Earnings were up. So back to climbing, we were $28 million for earnings in the quarter. That's up from $9 million last quarter. We still expect there's a ways to go on earnings, and we're looking forward to them being up again next quarter. I think as Kathy mentioned in our last quarter call, we're anticipating that our earnings are going to get closer to matching our dividends later in 2017. So, you know, from that perspective, I think our board of directors is reluctant to make much of a knee-jerk reaction to our dividend level. We're going to wait and see how our earnings pan out as we progress through 2017 here and see if we can't get them back up to that dividend level by the end of the year. Speaking of earnings, I think we were one of a very few producers to show earnings again this quarter and one of a very few to have positive earnings for the 9 months of the year. That's a big achievement. In this industry right now, I know some people like to argue that earnings don't matter for oil and gas companies, but I think we at Peyto totally disagree with this sentiment. Earnings are profits, and sooner or later, a lack of profits just spells doom for any business. So, you know, I think we're very proud of our track record of earnings, 47 consecutive quarters to be exact. There are even fewer companies that can claim that they have that kind of profitable track record. So, you know, we're quite proud of that accomplishment and think it's important for shareholders, especially when we look at, you know, the growth that we're seeing in our asset base. Our production per share, for instance, when you adjust for debt and dividends, is still growing at that 25% compound annual rate, has been for the last six consecutive years now. And I think because you pair that with solid earnings, you know that that growth is profitable and it's accretive for the shareholders. So, that's the biggest measure that we know of to ensure that what we're doing is making money for shareholders. So a quick review of the quarter. You know, I want to take the opportunity, since we do have the entire Peyto management team in the room today, to maybe go around the room and have each of them provide a bit of color, hopefully in the process answer some of the questions that listeners might have and that have been coming in overnight, and hopefully take advantage of their understanding of our business to give you guys a little more insight. So starting off, I want to start off with Scott Robinson, and just from a high level, Scott, you know, we got another big budget for 2017 planned, 150 wells, which I think that'd be a record amount of drilling for us. You get to see everything that Peyto's doing in detail, you know, but from a high level, what do you think the most exciting parts are for next year's capital plan?
Good question. As usual, I think there's a lot to be optimistic and excited about with the program for next year. You know, as we wrap up this year, 2016, I think we can say, as you've commented, that we are firing on all cylinders, and I believe the things that we've accomplished in this very tight gas market has really set the table, both with the projects we're doing and with our approach to those projects. I expect that we'll see very impressive year-end results on a cost per unit to reserve and cost production basis. And I'm excited to see that we'll carry that forward with that acute focus into the 2017 year. I know our team enjoys the challenge of this tight gas price market, and they're very ready, and they've already sifted through the project choices to create a very good starting lineup for the 2017 year. One specific dimension of next year that I'm eager to see how far we can take and that's the Brazos area with another year of growth. Dave and JP will be able to comment maybe more on the details of Brazos, but thus far, the way I look at it, we spent the last few years proving out some great ideas, and all the while we've been building an infrastructure platform there at Brazos that's going to be strategic for Peyto for many years ahead. So as we finish up this year and move into next year, I think we'll see a greater concentration of benefits of the fruits of this foundation that we've laid over the last few years at Brazos. And when you think about it, it's really amazing. It's a few short years ago that we dropped in a really small starter plant. It was the end of 2013-2014. And the way things are lining up, we could see our production hitting 200 million cubic feet a day by the end of next year, or maybe even sooner, sometime in the third quarter. So that's a tremendous amount of growth in a short period of time, and it's a real testament to our ability to focus and make things happen in a intelligent fashion. And I'm sure as we rack up the score on that, we'll see that it's not just growth, but it's, as we've stated, it's the associated profit of the growth that will really be the impressive part of the Brazos property.
Yes, excellent. I agree. Thank you. Kathy Turgeon, our CFO. Kathy, I got a tough question for you here. One of the reasons that I think our earnings are so consistent every quarter is that we go to the trouble of doing hedge accounting, and I know there are not many companies in the E&P space that do it this way, but I think it's interesting and it's important, and maybe you can help explain that difference to investors and those listening in, and what's the advantage of us doing it this way, of doing hedge accounting, and maybe what's the advantage even to our investors?
Sure, Darren. So as everyone knows, it's very common in our industry for companies to hedge items such as commodity prices, interest rates, foreign currency exchange rates, to lock in prices and costs at an acceptable level, which facilitates longer-term planning and protecting earnings against volatility. Companies enter into a variety of different types of future contracts to set these prices. These contracts must be valued at the end of every quarter to current market value and included on the balance sheet as an asset or a liability. The change in the current market value from quarter to quarter is what gives rise to an unrealized hedging gain or loss, and that has to be included in the income statement. So this can lead to large swings in earnings, which can make statements hard to understand. For example, when commodity prices decrease, the value of the hedges increase, so all of a sudden you have a large unrealized gain, which drives earnings up. Seems a little counterintuitive. And the same when commodity prices increase, then you have hedging losses, and your earnings are decreased. These are non-cash items, so cash flow is not affected, just earnings. So under IFRS, companies can do hedge accounting, which is an optional accounting model where these unrealized hedging gains or losses don't flow through the income statement. Instead, they flow through a separate financial statement called the Statement of Comprehensive Income. And therefore, the earnings on the income statement are less volatile and reflect actual profitability. So why do so few companies use hedge accounting? To apply hedge accounting, you have to use meet some specific criteria. In addition to calculating the unrealized hedging gains or losses, as I already described, you also have to do an effectiveness assessment. So you have to determine how well do these hedging items actually match the real transactions. Sometimes there's no directly comparable hedging contracts available to enter into. A company might want to hedge condensate, but only can enter into a contract for oil. So this results in a mismatch where the hedge does not perfectly protect the actual transaction. That mismatch must be quantified and put through the income statement every quarter. So at the end of the day, even with hedge accounting, there might be these non-cash, unrealized gains and losses going through the income statement, causing volatility in earnings. So it just doesn't seem worth the effort and the time. But at Peyto, we do use hedge accounting, and the reason that we can is because our hedging strategy is so simple, using future AECO contracts to lock in our future AECO sales. That means our hedges are 100% effective, there's no mismatch, so there's no portion that needs to go through the income statement. All unrealized hedging gains or losses flow through the statement of comprehensive income. The benefit to the users of our financial statements is that our earnings are comparable over time, and are the actual realized results of the operations of the company.
Good. Thank you.
Baffling.
No, that's very important to understand because we have consistent earnings every quarter. And a lot of companies, when you compare our earnings to other companies, they don't. They're one quarter they have earnings, the next quarter they have losses. And so a lot of that is the way in which they're doing their accounting that causes that variability and that volatility, but it forces then investors to have to look quarter over quarter and year over year at sort of a continuous running total of their profitability. Whereas for us, you can look at the quarter, you can see our earnings, and every quarter you know whether we're being profitable or not, right? So I think that's very important. Okay, switching gears, Dave Thomas, let's talk a little bit about resources. Dave, we drilled our second faulted Cardium well this past quarter down in Graz. It's a very rare thing for us these days to drill a vertical well. And I know it's early days on this play, but the Cardium for us in the early days of Peyto was a huge play. It was our sole bread and butter. Can you give us a bit of insight as what you see for the potential in this play down in Brazeau and how that fits into our 2017 plan?
Hey, you bet, Darren, but after following Kathy here, she sounded so smart, I'm just going to talk about rocks. Yes, it's still early days, but we like what we see so far. The gas rates aren't spectacular, but the liquid rates are really excellent. And we've identified over 80 faulted Cardium locations of grass. Initial production rates are 2 to 3 million cubic feet of gas per day, but the liquids production rates are in the 50 to 100 barrels per million cubic feet range. It's a nice complement to the liquids-rich Nanacune we have there, and as I mentioned before, one of the things that makes the faulted Cardium really special at Brazeau is the location of many of the faults sits right over top of the deeper Wilrich and Nanacune targets. So when we drill down to the deeper targets, we get a free look at the Cardium, and we can use that information to really fine-tune our seismic models to hit the shallower Cardium faults at the best possible location. We also get to save costs by being able to just skid the drilling rig on the same surface lease to spot our Cardium drills. So for our 2017 drilling program, we've lined up about 12 faulted Cardium verticals, all of which will be paired up with horizontal wells targeting deeper zones on the same lease. This stacking up of the deep basin targets at Brazeau is one of the reasons we'll be shooting even more 3D seismic this winter. A brand new 3D seismic's always one of the funnest things that we do on the GMG side. Maybe it's not quite as fantastic as looking at your new baby on ultrasound, but getting the very, very first look at what's under the ground is always something we really look forward to. And last winter, Peyto shot over 90 square miles of new 100% proprietary 3D data at Brazeau, which at the time was a record for us. And last year's program worked out so well for the Nanacune and Cardium that we'll be shooting an even larger amount of 3D at Brazeau this winter.
Very exciting. I want to hit JP Lachance, our VP Exploitation, up for a question here. JP, as part of our budget process every year, we do this full-cycle post-mortem look back on the results from the past year of activity, or at least as much activity as we can evaluate, and look at the economic impact of that, and then obviously we want to incorporate that into our plans going forward. So you've just done that. What's been the best parts of 2016 capital program from a returns perspective? Maybe what have been some of the challenges that we saw last year as it pertained to our economic results, and how does that play into our plans for next year?
Yeah, Darren, we, as you mentioned there, we conducted a recent look-back analysis of the results of 2016 wells to the end of Q3. We examined the actual costs we spent on each well and replicated the net operating income received to date. We apply our internal view of reserves against the current strip of commodity prices and to come up with an internal rate of return of our program and for each well. And as always, we include a capital cost provision for each well to share in the major facilities, the land, the seismic, and the other acquisition costs for the year, so to ensure we have a full cycle analysis. We include the good, the bad, and the ugly when we roll up all the numbers so as not to hide any failures. So our most recent analysis is consistent with what I spoke of at the end of the Q2, with total program returns estimated to be between 25 and 30%. Our best and most consistent results have come from our Not a QM program across all the company's land base, with an average full cycle return estimated at 44% on the capital that we deployed for those wells. Our Sundance Upper Flare wells yield an estimated 27%, while our large Wilrich program is estimated to yield 25%. As mentioned by Dave there, we drilled a couple of faulted Cardium wells this year down in Brazeau with high liquid content that have performed very well thus far, and we expect that they'll have returns well over the 50% mark. Now, if we were to break that program down by our two focus areas this year, the Braz area wells yield the best results with a composite 38% return, while Sundance still comes in a very respectable 23% full cycle return. Well, Peyto has demonstrated that we can consistently drill and complete horizontal Spirit River wells in Sundance for a total of only $2.5 million. When we couple that with the production performance we've been getting repeatedly year over year, it's understandable how we can still make good returns in today's price environment. Now, however, you know, Peyto's not, as Darren alluded to, Peyto's not immune to our challenges. As an example, our Sundance Middle Flare program did not fare as well as the rest of our species. So we've got work to do to get improvements on the well performance and on our and or on our cost structure to get the acceptable returns on that play going forward. So building on our knowledge and successes of 2016, we have a drilling program for the next year that's focused a little more down in the Brazeau area. We will add a fourth rig, drilling rig down there in the new year, and we'll expect to drill about 60 wells in total. That's our biggest program yet for that area. The bulk of that program will focus on the deeper, prolific Notikewin and Wilrich formations, which undoubtedly will confirm the additional faulted Cardium locations that Dave alluded to. We have a large presence in the greater Sundance area with a significant infrastructure in the way of plants, pipelines, roads, existing well sites to help keep our costs down. So we'll exploit that, and we'll drill approximately 90 locations there to keep our plants full and running efficiently. The Wilrich continues to provide good returns, and it will be our primary focus again in 2017 in Sundance. But we'll also continue a steady diet of Notikewins on the heels of that program. And based on 2016 results, the flare drilling is expected to be a smaller part of that Sundance program for 2017. Now, lastly, I should add that when we stress test our plays at $2 gas with our current cost structure, many of our species of wells still yield returns over 20%, which should keep us very competitive as we continue to grow.
Excellent. Thanks, JP. Let's look at the land world, Tim. You're our VP of land, and it seems like this year we seem to have had more success buying undeveloped land and drilling opportunities from other operators than we've had really buying it at Crown land sales, which is a bit unique for us. Usually we're sort of just the Crown land sale kind of guys, or maybe a few odd farm ends, but we've had some relatively good-sized deals come in the door this year. So from a high level and from what you see, and based on sort of upcoming land expiries and this sort of similar commodity price environment looking out into 2017, what do you think? Do you think we'll be doing this more of the same, or are we going to be returning sort of to more conventional Crown land sales for our land inventory in the next year?
Thanks, Eric. As you had mentioned, the tendency in prior years was to acquire a greater percentage of our lands at Crown sales. Although we're still picking up undeveloped land at sales this year, we have acquired more lands and spent more acquisition dollars through negotiated deals. Peyto's sustained drilling levels over the past year, combined with minimal activity by other operators, has created acquisition opportunities for Peyto. Companies that are distressed and possibly may be looking to improve their balance sheet through divestments have been more willing to do deals this year. We've also acquired expiring lands where the selling party did not have the capital to drill well. Expires are not a concern for Peyto due to our drilling activity. So what's in store for next year? There's still going to be a mix of Crown sale purchases and negotiated deals. We're constantly looking at prospective lands that are undisposed and can be posted for upcoming sales. We also keep track of the expired profile of lands held by other operators. This may result in a negotiated acquisition, or in some instances, we'll just wait for the lands to expire and then repost. However, I would anticipate that this year's trend towards a greater level of negotiated deals to continue into next year. We continue to work on the tuck-in acquisitions adjacent to our existing core lands. Although these are smaller purchases, they still add to our drill inventory. However, we are working on some larger initiatives, and we're optimistic that some of these plans will come to fruition, at which time we can provide more information.
Awesome. Exciting stuff. Let's talk about drilling and completion operations for a second. Lee Kearns, our VP of Drilling and Completions. Lee, we keep hearing, I think this fall, that the general sentiment next year is for increased activity, increased capital spending. That seems to be the tone coming out of a lot of companies. We picked up a rig recently. I sort of asked you this question last quarter as well, but maybe you can provide a little more color too, that with this level of increased activity, what do you think the industry's challenges are going to be, and what can we do to prepare for those kind of challenges?
Sure, Darren. Activity in the basin has been increasing in a slow but steady manner since we came out of spring breakup. However, in reality, it's only really just begun to approach levels that we were experiencing a full year ago. For that matter, over in British Columbia, activity is still running approximately half of what it was this time in 2015. As you mentioned, we contracted a ninth drilling rig in early September to supplement our activity in West Brazeau. Through the period of contracting services to supply this rig, we found no material change in service pricing, and still, as of today, we haven't experienced any real pressures to begin pricing increases. Now, those pressures will certainly occur at some point in time. However, as a whole, the service sector is still currently oversupplied. We are noting a few sectors, and primarily the pumping service elements, that are experiencing some minor growing pains that are related to personnel shortages. And as we're all aware, a lot of horsepower was idled over the past couple of years, and along with that, these firms were forced to idle a significant number of field personnel. Given how prolonged a duration this period of uncertainty has gone on, these service providers have perhaps been a little cautious in adding back those personnel, but they're accomplishing that as we speak. These minor personnel shortages haven't materially affected us to date, outside of a little bit of extra juggling in terms of our completion schedule. Peyto's overall activity level hasn't dramatically changed over the past several years, and as a result, our service providers have a high degree of confidence that their planning decisions and allocation of resources, and that includes their personnel, to conduct Peyto's capital programs are really low-risk decisions. This low-risk element helps us preserve our pricing structure. As well, it helps preserve consistent personnel and the resultant high quality of service. The key ingredient to our operational success is this consistency. A recent review of our drilling rig fleet showed 6 of our 9 active rigs having provided consistent, uninterrupted service to Peyto since 2012. And with 2 of those, they've been over 7 years with us. We've secured many of the required services to conduct our program through the first half of 2017, removing as much pricing variability as practical without laying out a bunch of capital to pre-purchase inventory. Specifically, our drilling rig contracts extend into the second quarter, as well as much of our pricing commitments for tangible goods, such as casing and tubing, have been locked down. Our plan is simply to hold firm on the contracting and execution strategies that we've been using for the past half decade or so. We're ready to roll on an active program in 2017. We expect to retain our top-tier performance and much of the cost advantages that we've worked so hard to accomplish.
Thanks, Lee. I think that's, a critical point. One of the questions we get a lot, I think, from analysts is, why aren't we doing more? We do want to be countercyclical to the industry. We do want to deploy a lot of capital in an opportunistic environment. But we do have to be careful, right? And those services that have been providing us long-standing service for a while are the ones we have the highest degree of confidence in and the ones where we have the most stable cost structure that we can predict. So, yeah, I think that's, you know, a key variable to looking at either expanding or shrinking our program is the service supply side that we've got and have had for a number of years. Okay, one more around the room. We've got Todd Burdick, our VP of Production. Todd, I want to finish off the questions with you, and then we can open it up to some questions from the listeners. But first, let's talk a little about that $100 million of infrastructure spending we've got planned for next year. A new Brazeau East gas plant, big liquids pipeline project we've got. That kind of stuff. Those are relatively big projects. $100 million is not a small amount of money, so they don't get built overnight. Maybe you can give us an update as to sort of how far along we already are on some of those projects, and any issues that might affect the timing of installation and on stream.
Sure. Things are well underway for both projects. At Brazeau East, the first phase of construction, which will add 70 million cubic feet a day of processing and compression capability, and as Scott mentioned, take the total processing capacity of Braz up to 200 million cubic feet a day. Much of the major equipment's already been fabricated, including the inlet separator, the LPG storage bullets, the refrigerant process skid, and two of the first six compressors. The other four compressors are in fabrication. They're slated for delivery prior to road bans coming on. All the vendors are currently on schedule for their stated delivery dates, and we still anticipate a start date for the first phase in Q2 of 2017. Engineering and bid evaluation is also well underway on phase two of the new plant. We're positioning ourselves to be able to have that expansion ready for operation later in 2017 or early in 2018, sort of depending on how the pace of drilling down in Braz goes. Of course, we don't necessarily need this second phase to reach our 120,000 to 125,000 BOE a day target in 2017, but we'll be positioned in case we need to bring it on. And of course, we need to get all this new gas to market. So TTPL recently completed a meter station upgrade at Gray Owl Creek, which takes that capacity up to 125 million cubic feet a day. And they've got another expansion planned for July 1, 2017, which coincides with the startup of the new plant. On the inter-plant liquid pipeline connection, it's going to be licensed in eight segments. Five of those eight are in various stages of the land acquisition. If there are any delays in acquiring those PLAs, then that could conceivably push the construction into Q2. As it stands now, based on the PLAs that we have in hand or are close to receiving, we'll have the Nose Hill to Old Man connection completed first. And that portion also includes some gas gathering debottlenecking as well. Engineering for the pump stations is well underway, and we don't foresee deliveries of the equipment causing any delays. And I should also mention that this pipeline project, it'll take 10 to 12 tanker trucks off the roads in the greater Sundance area every day. So that'll help ease road congestion, increase the driving safety, and also help to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions.
Awesome. Sounds like the engine of Peyto is revving along quite nicely. So that's just a quick round the room to add a little color. Wayne, maybe we can throw it open to listeners and see if they've got any questions.
Thank you. We will now take questions from the telephone lines. If you have a question and are using a speakerphone, please pick up your handset before making your selection. If you have a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. You may at all times cancel your question by pressing the pound key. Please press star 1 now if you have a question. There will be a brief pause while participants register. Thank you for your patience. Our first question is from Brian Christianing from Dundee Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Good morning, guys. Appreciate the color on the faulted Cardium and your plans in 2017, but can you comment on either what you've seen to date on prior penetrations or your latest Belly River well and the plans there?
Sure. Throw it down to Dave. Maybe you can provide.
Well, we just drilled our first Belly River well. Belly River is awfully hard to predict. So, you know, from a geologist point of view, we don't want to say too much about the future for that play. Our first well has just come on stream at a little under 5 million a day, but it's still very early days. And how many follow-ups to that we see? We see quite a few, but there's a lot of risk in the Belly River. So I don't want to lead people astray with making predictive statements.
Okay.
The cardiums are thin, and the pressures are very high. 35,000 kPa initial reservoir pressures, and it is a play that will be very complementary to what we have, and as I mentioned before, we'll be able to exploit it a little more cheaply than in other areas, which is fantastic. So we do have a lot lined up for it, and what's previously in the area, well, there is not very much out there. This is really a new play in the area that we're drilling it. Up to the northwest, Santonia did some horizontal wells, and they had a kind of mixed success. And we're just drilling with verticals, and we get to have that free first look whenever we drill down through it. So I think that's a fantastic situation to be in, to not to spend the money to try to tackle it with expensive horizontal wells, but just to do it with verticals. And at some stage in the future, we may even complete them in the same well bores as our deeper horizontal penetrations.
Okay. When you're referencing hard to predict, is that based on, you know, it doesn't resolve on seismic, or are you chasing it to date just based on your existing penetrations? Because I'd assume every well you've got basically goes through it.
Well, the Belly River is not very easy to image it on seismic, and it's the shallowest formation that's typically drilled in the area. The biggest risk is that you're outside of the deep basin drilling environment, and you can get water in many areas at the Belly River. So there's significant risk in incorporating it into your drilling strategy. We'll see how it goes. That's still very early days. There are a couple of really nice offsetting Belly River wells that I would point out.
You know, Brian, if you compared it to Sundance, for instance, we've got, I don't know, probably close to 1,000 wells in the greater Sundance area so far, all of which would have went through the Belly River.
Yep.
And what do we have, maybe 20 Belly River completions?
More than that. But
is it more than that? Maybe 30, but it's a pretty small percentage relative to the total number of penetrations. Like Dave said, it's not a traditional deep basin reservoir. There is mobile water. It's smaller accumulations. You got to be on structure. You got to have the right trap environment, as well as get all the other reservoir quality sand considerations. In a lot of ways, it's a tough target for a primary target. As an uphole zone that you can catch in some wells, it's a lot easier. So you have to be pretty careful when you're actually drilling for the Belly River itself, because then it's not just a secondary, it's a primary target. But like Dave said, you know, when we've seen it quite clearly on the wells that we've penetrated through it, and it's clearly good, we can go after it. But Sundance, I think, is a great analog in that
the number of times that it's that good in the uphole that we can drill in a separate Belly River well, it's not that great. So.
Okay.
And they're really extensive and predictable.
Yeah, it's not a traditional resource play like the Cardium or the Wilrich or any of these other deep basin zones that we're chasing and have been developing for many, many years.
Got it. Yeah.
That's really sharp of you to pick up on it because that's brand new.
Yeah. Thanks for the color. And then I guess potentially on the commingling, would you expect to commingle or try a well specifically for dual formations in 17?
You know, it's a consideration. We're saving, obviously, redrilling the vertical portion of the well. The concern, of course, is always, you know, after you've just spent all this money to drill down horizontally to a deeper target, complete that deeper target, and then you're going to put a plug over it and complete a shallow target, there's risk, right, that you potentially lose all that capital that you've invested in that lower horizon. To save the incremental cost just to rip back down to that shallow target. So that's, you gotta trade that off. You gotta look at the economics of just getting the rig over and redrilling a cheaper vertical well to that shallow target versus, plugging off your deeper zone temporarily and going after that shallow target. We've done it lots in, Sundance. You know, a lot of the vertical wells we had in Sundance were commingled, where we moved up. But it was always that same risk-reward analysis. And as the, you know, wells get more expensive and there's more complicated completions down below you in the horizontal section, you know, the tendency to want to just put that below a plug temporarily, there's a risk you can't get back to it. That, you know, you gotta analyze the reward and what the savings really is.
It also has some complexities on the production side. You introduce some shallow perforations. It might limit what you can do with the later stage production of the horizontal well. So it's a lot of considerations before you start putting zones together.
And then you got to look at the production, right? The production you get if you commingle the two formations together is a combined, and you don't get any information on what's the individual zones giving you, what's their contributions, and what are the economics of just an individual completion. And that's, for us, that's very important, right? We're always looking back at the economics that we're getting from each and every well we drill as confirmation that the money we're investing is getting us the returns we're looking for. So it's not just, you know, go crazy, get production on and look forward at production growth. We're looking back for return to make sure we're generating the return on that capital. And so the information for us is quite important.
Got it. Appreciate the context. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for the questions.
Thank you. Once again, please press star 1 if you have a question. The following question is from David Popowicz from CIBC. Please go ahead.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my question today. My question is just on the dividend. As you mentioned, last quarter you guys said that you think you could be in a position to pay your dividend out of earnings by the second half of 2017. Is there any way we could, you know, get a sense of the gas price you were using in that assumption that you would be in a position to do that?
Well, we were using the strip, but the strip is changing pretty fast, as we can appreciate, right? Just in the last month, the forward curve has moved around a lot. We've probably lost almost 50 cents on the 2017 strip in the span of about 4 to 6 weeks. So, it's hard, right? Because we're forecasting 1 month, and it looks very, very good. Like we're generating enough earnings to pay the dividend out of earnings. And then the next month, it looks like it's not because the gas price has changed so dramatically. So that's why I say it's a difficult moving target, but at the same time, we don't want to just say, okay, well, now we're confident the dividend can be paid, or now we're not confident the dividend can be paid when, you know, 3 weeks goes by and that answer changes. So
right,
I guess we have to look at it, you know, over time. But and it, I guess it's somewhat relative. I mean, it's important to us that
that from a sustainability standpoint, that we generate earnings that support that dividend level over time. And historically, that's been the case. You know, we look back at the 13 years we've been paying out an income model, $2 billion in dividends, $2 billion in distributions, and $2 billion in earnings. So there's decent match there. But there were years when it was mismatched, for sure. And I think we got to probably anticipate that going forward the next 10 years, there's going to be a bit of mismatch as well. But if after a long period of time, we can look back and say we've managed to pair them up, then I think we've done a good job, and that speaks to their sustainability. You look at a lot of companies that have dividend models, and so do I. We are by far and away the most conforming when it comes to dividends that match earnings of any dividend model I can see in the industry. So, you know, if it's a challenge for us, it's an incredible challenge for some of these other guys that they've got dividends going out the door and they've got no earnings.
Oh, I agree. I mean, I guess I just wonder that, you know, if you guys are the gold standard, I mean, and, you know, you have a difficult time doing that, then how does it speak to the health of the industry at large? So I guess that's kind of where I'm coming from. But I guess
you're absolutely right. I mean, in this commodity price environment we're in, a dividend-paying E&P model is extremely challenging. But, you know, even when we were a trust back in, you know, that we were a trust from 2003 to 2010, there were a lot of trusts in those days that really didn't have a sustainable income model either. And, you know, investors had to be wary. They had to look at the right metrics to see whether there was sustainability in that income. And a lot were fooled. You know, there was a lot of dividends and distributions that are paid out of debt, that are paid out of equity, that aren't sustainable because they're not coming out of profit. You know, we've long suggested that that should be the gold standard, that dividends come out of earnings, but that doesn't seem to be the case very much in the industry.
Right. I guess so, too. I was just interested in your hedging policy. I mean, it was interesting to see that you guys increased the proportion of your gas volumes that are hedged to 85% right through summer 2017. So, I mean, would it be safe to say that at the new hedge price and proportion of volumes, you feel more comfort that you'll continue to pay the dividend out of earnings into next year? Or how much is the decision to hedge more volumes driving your dividend policy?
I don't think it is. I think the hedging is more driven by our observation of the volatility in natural gas prices and the wanting some certainty in price. For sure that, you know, having certainty in price gives us certainty in earnings, gives us certainty in our ability to fund that dividend. It also gives us certainty, really what we're looking for more than that is certainty on the capital program, right? We've got close to a $600 million capital program planned. We've got $200 million in dividends planned. So capital program is three times the amount of dividends that we've got going out the door. For all that, when you combine the two, yeah, we're looking for some certainty on our cash flow and some certainty on that price. And we're looking for it in a world where, right now, anyway, volatility has been increasing quite dramatically. I think, I don't know, somebody said the volatility in natural gas in 2016 has been like 500% or something crazy. You know, and we've seen it, right? The 1 week the price is 50 cents, the next week it's 250. That kind of extreme volatility is very difficult to plan around. And the hedging helps smooth that out. That's really what we're designed with our hedging program to do, is to smooth out that volatility. And our perception is, with the TransCanada issues that we've observed over the last year or two, with, you know, the evolution of the Marcellus competing with Canadian gas in eastern markets, and with a lot of, you know, sort of this new resource play in Western Canada being developed, our feeling is that this volatility is going to continue. We're going to see it into 2017. And so in the very near term especially, we're looking for some price security and some confidence that we can plan out this capital program, make these investments, and know that, at least in the short term, what we're going to get.
Right. And just in relation to the capital program, without knowing how your expected CapEx breaks out by quarter, I'm modeling a similar payout, you know, I'm wondering you guys having more cash going out the door than coming in the door for at least the next three quarters. So if I look back at past years, I mean, that's a similar payout ratio that you've had in 2015 and 2016, and you've financed that CapEx outspend with an equity financing. I mean, is there any reason to expect why that might not be the case in 2017?
Well, I think the delta for us in 2017, as we see it on the strip, is smaller going forward and has shrunk over time. You know, we recently fixed $100 million of term debt. That looked very attractive to us from a cost perspective. So that added the $100 million of capacity, if you want to say, that we needed over and above the dollars going in versus the dollars coming out. So, you know, I think we're sitting quite comfortable in terms of our balance sheet. Right now, I don't really need, I don't see the need for external funding. But, you know, as Tim mentioned, there's a lot of dynamic going on with acquisitions, with asset dispositions, with lands trading hands this year, and we expect that to continue into next year. I think we just heard this morning that one of the big major players in the basin is deciding to exit. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of those kind of opportunities too. And so that's over and above anything that we see in terms of our capital plans for this year. Maybe we will need some external funding if we want to pursue some of those opportunities. But, you know, we'll wait and see what happens there. We need to see whether we can be successful and whether they're the right opportunities and the right lands that we want to get our hands on.
Terrific. Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for the question.
Thank you. The following question is from Travis Wood from National Bank Financial. Please go ahead.
Thank you. In terms of the budget that you've set out, it seems that you've embedded somewhere around a 10% cost deflation for 2017. Can you provide color? You've just added another rig. So can you provide color around the quality of rigs that are available, the quality of the crews that are around to run those rigs, and if you see further cost inflation through, you know, this winter into the spring and into the summer?
Let me start, and then we'll get Lee to add some color here, Travis. It's a great question. So I think what you're referring to, 11,500 of flowing is up from sort of the 10,000 or even sub 10,000 of flowing that we're currently experiencing. Is that right?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So a little bit of that is perhaps a slightly heavier infrastructure spend. I think we were expecting in 2016 our infrastructure facilities and big pipe projects to be about 14% of the total capital program, and the $100 million that we have planned for next year is about 17, 18% of the capital program in and around the midpoint of that guidance. So, you know, it's a slightly heavier spend on facilities in anticipation of, you know, the growth in volumes that we're going to see down in Brazeau. And then a little bit of it, too, is, you know, what we've just, I guess, experienced and what Lee was talking about, a little bit of delays perhaps in some of the fracking and pumping services. And, you know, if we see the industry pick up activity, which they're all talking about doing, then there's, you know, a little bit of caution that there might be a bit of that creeping in. But, you know, I'll let Lee expand upon some of the things we've done to prevent against that, but at the same time, we want to be realists in terms of where costs can go. And, you know, Lee, I don't think you think that the costs are going to go down 20% from where we're at this year.
I don't see significant magnitudes, but, I mean, if, you know, if history is of any measure, I don't think I would have predicted a year ago that costs would have accomplished the levels that they're at today. We often look at opportunities potentially to lock in levels of pricing. There's obviously a reluctance to do so from a variety of service product sectors, because they do see the potential upside coming. That being said, you know, our workload has been so consistent and predictable that we've kind of become the anchor tenant in the industry, and And although we will see some cost pressures associated with an increase in activity, we're going to be at the tail end of that. You know, our strategies have preserved, you know, industry preferential pricing and supply over the past half decade, and I see no reason that that would change. There's still a lot of equipment idled. The equipment's not the problem. Personnel is a potential problem in the sector. You know, I think a lot of it, you know, some of the service companies are speaking about, you know, a rehire program and potentially having trouble finding new people. On the same note, you got to take that with a little bit of a grain of salt. You know, they are being very cautious as they hire new people. They don't want to, you know, just jump on the bandwagon and go through these massive hiring events just to turn around and march people out the door should things turn the other way again, which, you know, is always potential.
You know, Trav, we always have the seasonality of some of the activity, too. We take advantage. We probably give up a bit of competitive advantage in the winter when everybody's busy and everybody's demanding services. We get it back during breakup sometimes. When we drill through breakup, we get some preferential cost treatment. We drill through the summer pretty steady, and you know, not everybody can work through the summer because of ground conditions, although arguably that was hard for us this year, too. But there is some ebb and flow in the cost pressures that we see just based on the seasons. But at the same time, you know, we're trying to be realistic. Of course, we're going to keep grinding away as we always do, and I wouldn't be surprised at all if we're coming back to you this time next year saying, hey, we're doing it for 10,000 of flowing or less because we've managed to make gains we didn't anticipate. We did a great job as we're trying to do. But, you know, I'd hate to come out and say to you, we're going to do it for 8,000 of flowing because that's been the trend, and we're just going to extrapolate that trend. And then, you know, it's unrealistic for us to assume that. It's a lot of what the rest of the industry does, of course. Guys are doing it for 15,000 flowing, and they claim next year it's going to be 10. You know, we're saying we'll probably start by just repeating this year. That'd be a pretty good result. We're already leading the industry, I think, in terms of capital efficiency anyway. And in typical Peyto fashion, we're going to try and grind it down.
You know, I think another important point here is that we've got a larger proportion of our program down in Brazos this year. And as good as our cost structure is, it is a little bit more expensive to drill wells down there. They're a little deeper. So as a result, we've tried to model that. We've tried to recognize that. So you'll see that slight increase as well on the per well cost, perhaps on, you know, we'll continue to grind. But
well, and
the reason why that
and the other side of that is the production. And Brazos is still a little bit newer than obviously Greater Sundance area in terms of analog data. So
we're not
a little conservative on our expectation down there. Exactly. So. You know, we put all that together, and, yeah, we come up with a capital efficiency number and a ratio that it looks about the same, maybe a little bit higher even than what we're currently doing. But and maybe it is conservative. We'll be happy to come back to you in Q3 of 2017 and tell you we're doing it for 9,000 of flowing, and we've beat that 11.5.
The $100 million that you discussed and Todd gave color on includes $20 million of capacity that we don't need to do the plan that we have next year, and
right.
It's important. It could, if we push that into 2018, then we'll be $20 million less on the budget. If we spend it, that means the production is there, and we'll be higher on our exit rate, and it all kind of goes around.
Well, and the pipeline project, when you think about that, that's capital in exchange for operating costs, right? It's good economics, has good payout, good return on the capital we're deploying there, but we're not going to see it on the production side. You know, that's $15 million that isn't going to increase production is going to lower costs.
So drive higher liquid value, really.
Yeah, and so it doesn't show up on a capital efficiency ratio of dollars per flowing barrel, right? But it's very profitable, so that's why we do it.
Okay, so that kind of nuance there, that'll help drive the margins a bit higher with the help on the pricing plus kind of the lower cost side. Over time, and then just back on the crew specific side with this add of the rig, and I'm going to make the safe assumption that the crew's not listening to this call, But are you starting to see any marginal adds on in the field? Like, are you kind of moving to second liners and away from first liners as you add rigs at this point?
No, it was definitely having warm, capable, and experienced bodies was definitely part of the selection criteria for this rig. But we're not seeing the introduction of the second line on the ice at this point in time. For that matter, I did comment on the reduced activity in British Columbia, and you'd be surprised at how many resumes I receive a week that have recent or their most recent experience with British Columbia operators. So to me, I think there's still a lot of good qualified people out there. You know, we could face that at some point in time, but we're still sub 200 rigs in Western Canada, and that's pretty lean. You know, there's been years where we've looked at that number through a breakup. I don't think we're there. We've lost a few people in the industry, but I don't see it being a dire situation at this point in time.
Okay.
But it does play, you know, Trav, it does play into our decision as to how much capital program we want to try and deploy next year. You know, we had batted around a much bigger program than what we've laid out in this budget. And, you know, part of the concern was, well, we'd have to go get more equipment. And what's the quality of that? Is it going to be at the same level of efficiency that we've got today, or do we lose it? And there's no rush, right? At the end of the day, there's in the industry a limited number of opportunities that generate the really good risked return, and we know it because when you look at the earnings that companies are generating, they're absent, and therefore they're not getting the returns they think they're getting. And there's no rush to go out and harvest opportunities for a lower return. I don't think that's never been our goal. We don't want to just grow for the sake of getting bigger. We don't want to just be active for the sake of doing something. We want to go out and make a profit on the dollars we're investing. And to say that incremental dollar has to get less profit because we're trying to do too much too fast, that's an unacceptable answer. We want to make sure that we're getting the maximum possible profit off of every dollar and off of every well and off of every opportunity we're pursuing. So, you know, having a bit more of a careful, paced approach to our development plan, that's important to us.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You bet. Great questions. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. There are no further questions registered at this time. I would now like to turn the meeting back to Mr. G.
Great. Thanks, Wayne. Well, thanks, everybody, for listening in. Appreciate it. It's a really busy morning, so thanks for the discussion. Hopefully it was informative for everybody listening in, and we're excited about this fourth quarter. It's going to be a big one for us, lots of activity. We're going to pound through to the end of the year and hopefully finish off this very tumultuous year with a flourish and hopefully with less volatility than we've had to experience over the last couple of quarters. And heavy into 2017 with a good start. So let's go make Canada great again. Thanks for listening in.